Hi everyone, just a quick apology before the bulk of the show kicks off. We had some slight problems with the audio for this particular show, so there are some sections of the audio that get a little choppy with some words getting cut off here and there. I am really sorry for that. I will try and bludgeon my cloud-based recording software to working a little better next time, and hopefully things like that won't happen again. So if things are skipping, it is not a problem your end. It is a problem with the recording in a few places around about the half hour or so mark into the cast. I am so sorry about that, and I hope it doesn't detract from the overall listening experience. And with that, thank you, and please enjoy the show. Hello, and welcome to Written in Uncertainty, an Elder Scrolls podcast sat firmly in the grey maybe of Tamriel, and proud member of the Robots Radio Podcast Network. My name is Aramithius, and today we are, in a sense, leaving Tamriel. We are going east to some islands that no one really seems to talk about except for one or two people who talk about them a lot, and we are talking to one of them today. I am joined on the show today by Icefire Warden, or Athatur, who is one of the creators and the original mind behind the Utak mythos, which is a fantastic fan lore project. If you haven't heard of it, go and find its pages on the UESP. And I don't think it's stored anywhere else, LJ, at the moment.
Not exactly. It's just the UESP. I talked to him, I think, like a good year or two ago about hosting the pages on there to make it just a little bit more easier to navigate.
No, that's fair enough. Yeah, there's absolutely everything that you need to know about the Utak mythos, both as a fan project there and all of the texts that have been written by the various contributors to the project over time. And it's just one of those bizarre little one of those bizarre fan projects that's very much taken on a life of its own and has got its own kind of feel, almost distinct from Tamriel, as I see it. There are some elements to the Ekmer, the inhabitants of that sort of a world, that feel a little distinct from the rest of the Elder Scrolls and add something to the setting, which is part of what I absolutely love about it. Apart from the fact that it's just this corner that's of the world that's now had so much detail sunk into it that it feels that much more, almost that much more realistic, I want to say, than other areas of Tamriel. But I think we're possibly getting a bit ahead of ourselves. So, but LJ, did you could you give us just a brief intro on what Utak is and how it all started?
Yeah, certainly. Utak is mainly just a world-building project. It's largely focuses on writing and, you know, some art pieces and some other parts here and there, like songs and stuff like that. It takes part on Yeneslia, which is like a little island kind of mentioned briefly in like two textbooks in the lore, mainly dealing with Uriel Fitz's Akaviri invasion and his, well, failed Akaviri invasion, because, But, you know, it's something that nobody really talked about, and, you know, I'm always interested in, like, little, like, areas of the lore that nobody really seems that much interested in. That's one of the reasons why I'm known for, like, Parii and other things like that. If it doesn't have any attention, I'm going to give it some attention. But back when, honestly, it's like years ago. It's been like six, almost 7 years now. Back when like COVID and everything was happening, I briefly contacted Mike Kirkbride because, you know, I was interested in talking to him. Just wanted to know more about the lore and stuff like that from one of the dudes, and he's active in the community at the time. First attempt didn't go so well. I kind of just, like, you know, I was still a teenager at the time. I was pretty young, pretty impulsive. Didn't get a response. Tried again a couple of days later, kind of wrote like a little formal like letter, like I'm like trying to apply for some high-end job, and he was like, yeah, that's how you talk to people. And I was like, and that's how I met MK. And since then, like, I, you know, he gave me a couple of pointers of writing and the lore and stuff like that. And then when Coda was happening, I just like, you know, we should make like a little joke or like kind of like a little like writing piece. And he was like, yeah, that's not, like, that's what the whole thing's about. So we made like a little comic strip that was like, you know, it's still around. You can even see it on like the actual like Project Hub page, where it's like Vivek and, you know, like wearing a suit, and he's like sees like these bat people like flying across the screen. He's like, oh no, not the bat elves. And it's like, that was kind of like the start of Utak. And since then, it kind of has gone from being like, oh, just a couple really weird, looking back on honestly kind of poorly written pieces, and has kind of transformed into this like a lot more detailed, a lot more coherent project where it's trying to kind of like return a little bit to some of the roots that TDS used to have in like the older games, kind of like connecting the dots where there are some parts of the lore that are still pretty cool, but this kind of got forgotten about or partially retconned and stuff like that, that Utah kind of goes back into. And also just, you know, showing parts of the lore that hasn't got any love, because I feel like when people do that, it kind of helps inspire, like, you know, other people in the community and, you know, outside the community to kind of do more with their own writing as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I know that. Yeah, that's kind of something that you've done over the years. You've kind of taken these obscure bits and then just expanded them out and written reams on it. It's like, as you say, with Periite, and one of your other pieces that I will just always remember is kind of the exploration of the Prolix Tower and Draco Chrysalis and all that sort of stuff. Right. So it's absolutely fantastic when you just kind of finding a space and then just exploring it. So Bat Elves is kind of the central inspiration for the ECMA, so to speak. But can you talk about just what they are in terms of the creation in universe? I mean, I don't know exactly how many people who are going to be listening to this have read through the Utak Mythos. But can you kind of explain what their start was? And I'm a little curious about how the Dwemer were involved and what your thinking was behind getting the Dwemer into their genesis, and how that's kind of shaped how you think about them.
Right, because to be honest, like I said, years ago, like when the original kind of like incarnation of the project, the Dwemer were kind of there because if you wanted to make anything cool, you had a Dwemer. You know, they were like the mysterious high-tech guys in the setting that all mysteriously disappeared and died, and everyone's like, I want to know what's going on with them. So, you know, if you want to do something cool to grab someone's attention easily in an Elder Scrolls setting, you just like, oh, deep elves, robots, machines, you know, everybody here is, you know, science fantasy nerds, so, you know, of course it's going to grab their attention. But it's like, with the, how they kind of created that, where it's kind of like changed from the original one. In the first one, it was still kind of had an evolution kind of a tidbit to it, how they was kind of like explored different pathways to, you know, ascending as a race, which is actually kind of discussed a little bit in the lore too, how the Nemedian was kind of frowned down upon as a project because they thought it had a lot of, you know, negative implications of what could go wrong with it. So I kind of latched onto that idea that, you know, not all the Dwemer were really into the idea of Nemedian, and they kind of fractured because of it. And with the new incarnation, it kind of goes a little bit deeper into it, because I've kind of fleshed out how the Nurokin clan, which is the Yenezlian Dwemer, kind of like they kind of like had idealistic differences with their brethren on, you know, mainland Tamriel, and they're like, we're not really interested in the whole robot kind of shit. We're going to go focus more on genetic shit. And they kind of just left. And they were like, and they kind of started experimenting with like tonal architecture and like how, like, you know, the body and the mortal body works, because since elves want to return to divinity, you kind of want to start with the body. So that's kind of what their whole thing was. And that's kind of how the Ekmer became a thing, because they start experimenting on different localized plants and wildlife in Yenezlia. And then when the Ekmer kind of started becoming more than just bats, they kind of like, hey, we can use this as a slave force, as a labor force, as, you know, more experimentations. And that's kind of how the Ekmer developed. They kind of originally was just kind of like a project. And then when the Dwemer kind of disappeared, you know, they kind of just took control.
Okay, so I'm sorry, I'm just getting flashes of those Dwemer being almost the kind of the Darwin Dwemer, if I can put it that way, right down to having some Galapagos islands to go and experiment on. That's kind of how I see the kind of the Yenezlia chain almost. I'm possibly going to be picking also from some of the older stuff and some of the newer stuff just in my head, because I've seen various iterations of the project as we go. So if there's anything that you're saying isn't current, then just please do flag. But when you say that the Dwemer were trying to essentially uplift these bat type creatures, and use them to experiment on. Did you think about what that means for soul evolution, if I can put it that way? Because I know that there's some texts in there that talk about, oh, they changed from a white soul to a black soul at some point. But how do you think that, is there any kind of thinking about how the Dwemer made that sort of a change happen? I don't know. I think there might have been some pieces in there that address that, but I can't honestly remember.
Well, it kind of goes into like a lot of kind of like both like in universe kind of concept as well as out of universe concepts, like things that fans and developers have talked about over the years. But whenever I kind of like think about soul evolution, I automatically default to the Falmer from Skyrim and how they kind of went from having black souls to having white souls. And at least to me, the idea is that it's less of a metaphysical issue and still kind of more of it at the same time. Because to me, I think it kind of ties into the idea that belief kind of has a little bit of power in Elder Scrolls universe. So if, you know, you believe something is sapient and free thinking, it's sapient and free thinking, and therefore has enough authority on itself to register as a unique and higher level individual. So I almost kind of started thinking that the reason why the Falmer had white souls because they started believing in themselves as subhuman due to their slavery to the Dwemer and Skyrim and stuff like that, as well as with the Dwemer kind of already kind of treating them like animals that just kind of fed into their kind of like their soul evolution in a sense. With the Ekmer, it kind of goes the opposite direction. The Dwemer were, it's kind of like static a little bit, that the fact that they were able to actually change like a group of animals into being a group of, well, people, and how the implications of that with mortal life, since, you know, mortals are just a step down from godhood, and since everybody wants to rise higher up on that gradient to reach back to what they used to be, to them is proof of that concept. So with combining that they believe that the Ekmer kind of had individuality, along with their experimentations with the Ekmer eventually actually developing their own individuality, kind of resulting in them having, you know, black souls that you know is actually registered by soul gems. But of course, soul lore is very obscure, and soul gems themselves aren't really fully comprehended, you know, especially considering that originally they didn't really have that black white soul kind of transposition.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like you kind of always had to take souls with a grain of salt. And I know like the way they handle souls in the ESO is completely different than how they handle it in Oblivion, for example. Yeah. So you kind of had to, but that's, you know, you take what you can get.
Yeah, with as little hand waving as possible, basically. And my ears just kind of pricked up on something there slightly. The idea of kind of the Dwemer going back, it almost feels to me that the Ekmer are kind of going in another direction, particularly if you're talking about the creation and or talking about creating your way up the gradients and so on to godhood. Because if I don't that's possibly another question down the soul's rabbit hole now I think about it, but if you're looking at something that didn't have sentience and then giving them sentience, is that really backwards if you can kind of build your way towards godhood through all of the various intermediate steps and so on using things that weren't originally that? Is it that's not so much reclaiming as progress? Do you agree with that? Because and that also I think has kind of some possible implications for how the Ekma see things, because I read quite a few bits and I'm thinking this is almost feeling modern in its outlook, whereas there's not an awful lot of Tamrielic societies that I would necessarily apply that label to.
Right, I can definitely see that being a good kind of like theme with them, because especially in New Talk, I kind of like, because you know how like there's like that main, it's not like really like a joke, but it's kind of like a common phrase that people say about the Dwemer, that they're atheists in a world where gods exist. And with the Ekmer, especially in New Talk, I wanted to make I kind of make it like the inverse of that joke, with them being almost Christians in a world where God doesn't exist. And in the sense that, you know, they still acknowledge, you know, like, you know, creations and stuff like that, that there are higher powers, but due to the fact that they literally are a created species that kind of have traits of, you know, traditional mirrorish thinking, along with kind of like outlooks of mannish societies, along with being beast folk, you know, due to being evolved from bats, they kind of have a more of a, they don't really kind of look to, I guess, to like, they don't really focus on the idea of them kind of being trapped, in the sense that it's like, to them, they're like, hey, there's always a way to go up. There's always a way to progress into something newer and greater. So to them, everything kind of just descends from one source, one like greater power, and their kind of creation myths kind of focus on that. Even like, they still have the, like, their own version of like the monomyth, because, you know, a mixture of both dwarven stories and historical records and stuff like that, combined with like things they've learned from like traveling Akaviri and other, you know, civilizations in the Patamag Ocean. And then, but their second part of the creation myth focused like almost exclusively on how the Dreamer came to Yennezlia, because, and that's like the most important part to them, because they're not really focusing on like the world, they're focusing on, hey, this is how we became a thing, and this is why the mundane world is almost more important. So it's like, they're kind of modern in the sense they don't really have a important like as designation with the gods themselves, but to them, everybody's already kind of uniquely a part of this greater being, and they don't really talk about much. Even like, there's actually one of my favorite things I've written so far in New Talk, is how like with their version of I was writing like a pocket guide to Yennezlia, and there's like a Dalmor, I'll remember Alamary Dominion, who's annotating it, and we need like the fucking Imperial Geographic Society, he like writes about how the Ekmer basically don't worship gods and they're kind of heretics because of it, and like his like annotations, like, don't let the Imperials fool you. Like, you know, like, if you really look deeply into their society, they're very strangely monotheistic, and it's kind of disturbing. Because, you know, like, of course, it's the, you know, the Altmer, they don't, you, to them, like, an idea of, like, a monotheistic religion is probably, like, eh, because they're all about ancestor worship and stuff like that. And the Ekmer are, too, but it all ties back into this idea that there's a one, kind of like one god, and it just kind of, like, devolves from there.
Yeah, it's, although it almost feels the way that the I think is I'm trying to place where it is in the Ekmeri creation, where it feels a bit more cooperative, if I can put it that way, because the Ekmeri gods in their creation myth are much more concerned about, oh, is there enough room for everyone? Let's build more rooms and let's make sure that everyone is kind of happy in their own little apartment, sort of thing. That's almost how I read that. So it's a lot less kind of adversarial than quite a few creation myths, which I thought was really quite interesting. But I don't know if it's interesting that you're saying that there's those ideas of kind of monotheistic tones and another way of looking at it, because I was thinking, like, is this kind of a third way or a fourth way of thinking about how to look at creation? And it almost feels like if you are going for that sort of monotheistic, or at least monolatristic kind of outlook, the idea of there are many gods but only one really worth following, then it feels a bit like the skull outlook, if I can put it that way. It's not that extreme, I don't think, because you do acknowledge because the Ekmer do acknowledge all of those different creators within their own myths. But I was just curious about how you thought about how that interacted with the rest of how that interacted with all the rest of the Tamrelic myths.
Yeah, I think a major theme for the Ekmer's family. So to them, it's like everybody is kind of like all like this one huge kind of like clan, and then those clans diverge into different clans and get smaller and smaller. So for them, creation is less like, oh, like this god hates this god and he killed him and then this is why the world created. It's more like, hey, the family kind of broke apart, you know, everyone did some wrong, everyone did some bad, but we're not going to focus on those parts. We're just going to focus on why the world got created, and this is where everybody is now. And so you kind of have, like, for example, like a major thing about Ekman religion is that there's no really singular Lorcan or Agatosh identity. But there are, in the sense that there's, like, the gods that were born from that one god's corpse, but originally there was this one god of space and time, and it was Legardo. And he's portrayed as not even evil, and he's more sympathetic in the sense that he tried to do something really good for the other gods, and it fucked up, and he kind of got, like, a bad, not even a bad reputation. It's just like, yeah, he failed at what he was trying to do, and everyone mourned him because of it. But his death kind of caused issues, but that's just how things are, in the sense that, you know, that's why I said, like, the whole family idea is, like, really ingrained into their culture, because they just, they don't see the whole point of the fighting. And it's mostly because they're removed from the man-mer schism that everything else is plagued with. I think that's kind of what makes them kind of unique, especially, is that, you know, they kind of share both outlooks of both major groups of, you know, basically free-thinking individuals on Nern. And it's also the fact that to them, since they were literally came from animals, they basically came from the mundane world itself. So they're like an extra step removed from the gods, in a sense. So to them, they're more focused on the world and how everyone needs to cooperate to be able to, you know, live in the world than just, oh, we need to get out of the world because that's where we used to come from.
So kind of, I'm kind of hearing things like that's almost Khajiit, but without the moons.
Almost like Khajiit a little bit.
Yeah, because that's the whole kind of, again, got the family and the multiple litters and so on. But you kind of were talking about family being one of the big important things for the Ekmer and the various clans and so on. I remember reading somewhere that about all the different types of Ekmer, and there were almost different subspecies, if I can put it that way. Is that something that's still current? And if so, what's the sort of the thinking behind that? Is it that these clans are being tied to particular physiological capabilities, or how does that work?
Well, there was originally in the Otok, there was like four different subspecies based on different types of bats. You know,
yeah.
The ones that drink blood, the ones that eat fruits, the ones who are omnivorous, the ones who are mainly just like meat eaters and stuff like that. I kind of looked back on that while kind of like rebooting the project, and I was kind of like, that's kind of simplified. Yeah, I could do better than that. So now it's mainly just there's three major subspecies, one that looks more like elves, and one that looks more like bats, and then the other ones that look more like kind of like foxes. And the elves versus Kyrobatarian subspecies is more along the lines of which ones kind of like evolved a little bit more because of the Drimmer experiments. And then the fox ones came from like the little Moffat, who at least in Utah, a couple of them survived and kind of went to Unesli, and they kind of became part of the population. And over time, a new subspecies emerged because they got absorbed into the Ekmeri population. But in New Talk, especially, I want to focus less on like actual like subspecies and how, kind of like go against the idea that the different races kind of like break into different like parts based on like kind of like I guess physiological differences, and more kind of go with MK's original idea that there wasn't going to be any races and more just cultures. At least that's how he wanted to do it originally. Because I always kind of liked that concept. Yeah. I always thought it was like more interesting to have like different like ethnic groups more than, oh, this is this subspecies because of this. And in New Talk, you have like, you have the Ekmer, but you also have Unesleans as a whole. And then the Unesleans have different outlooks based on the islands they come from and the towns they come from. And, you know, like a someone from like Yene is going to be completely different in outlook than someone who comes from like Alsaia, for example, because Alsaia was originally supposed to be like a prison colony for ancient like nobles and stuff like that, who were kind of like betrayed or did really terrible things, and they kind of got mistreated because of it. So they're a lot more rebellious, a lot more hatred inclined, a lot more bitter to everyone else in Unesli. You know, they're they have a reputation for being kind of like terrorists in a sense, because they don't mind going out and just beating the shit out of people because they're treated really badly throughout history. While Yinnei is like, or I think they're called the Yinni, are more a common thing of other cultures because they're closer to the Western Hemisphere. Or you have Pasavagans, because that's where that's the home of magic, so they're more scholastic and stuff like that, and kind of evolves from there. So it's less of like what you kind of look like and more like where you came from, what you do, and more like that, that I'm trying to focus on more with the Yinezi as a whole, I think.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, that absolutely makes sense given the whole, particularly given kind of how, the phrase of kind of the ideologies given skin in the Dawn era, and that even if we are going to be talking about evolution within the Elder Scrolls, it's not exactly working in the way that it does in this world. So if those changes are going to happen, it's going to function kind of a little differently. One of the other ways that at least I picked up on while I was reading through it, as much as the gods are quite different, and trying to pick analogs for the gods, you've done a really good job of kind of obfuscating precisely where each one came from. I was like reading through the creation myth, I was convinced, oh, that one's Kinnereth, no, that one's Kinnereth, no, that one's Kinnereth, just as I was going through, and it's like, oh, you're saying, so that's saying that Akatosh and Lorcan are actually kind of eating each other, and Akatosh is the douche here, or what's going on? You've done a fantastic way of kind of obscuring all of those sorts of bits, but the one thing that stood out to me as I was reading through is that the language is quite different, the formulations of the phrases and so on, and the names are they're polysyllabic. There's apostrophes in many places, which just makes me wonder about all sorts of pronunciation. did you develop a conlang for this, or what was the kind of or you or the project in general? Because I assume that there's probably more than just you putting stuff in at that point.
In the original one, not at all. I was just this sounds cool in my head, and put it on paper. Now I'm trying to reorganize that into different ways, but also kind of keeping some of the old names alive by basically saying that the Ekmer language is always constantly evolving. They even have a god of literal sound and language, and for example, a lot of Ekmer language comes from Dramaris, and a lot of their older words are mispronunciations or misreadings of Dramaris, which came from Aldmeris. And they have some Hyoketic words from like their bug goblin neighbors thrown into the mix, along with words from Akavir, when the Kamal or Tseski tried to like raid them in the past. And then as time goes on, all those different languages kind of combine together, then start to diverge into different like local terms and slang and stuff like that. So you have like High Eki, which is like the oldest variant of Eki, which is like basically like Numeric, which is like ancestral Ekmer language, which is pretty much almost doesn't even make sense to modern day Ekmer because it's so wildly different. Then you have Low Eki, which is like a combination of Akaviri words with like old Numeric words. So they started becoming a lot more simplified, a lot more coherent. And that's also inspired by the fact that, and I guess in regards to an out of a universe perspective, as I'm writing it, I started to go with a more of a kind of a Chinese aspect for the Ekmer, to kind of like inspire them to be kind of more of their own unique culture. Then, threw in some Spaniard and Hispanic kind of like influence into the mix. And then you have modern Eki, which is kind of like the result of all of that. But in general, like their language, we are working on a colang. I have Melissa, so she's probably like the language master, that probably one of the few people I know is like extremely gifted in understanding linguistics. Awesome. And then there's Drac, who's he's literally like the oldest member of the project outside of me. Like, mm-hmm. I've known him for literal years, and we're both friends in the Elder Scrolls community. All of it, like, he's even my roommate in real life, and he does a lot of the language work as well.
Cool. And so you've talked a bit and just kind of referenced kind of old Tuck and new Tuck. There's kind of been a setting reboot as such. Can you talk a little bit about why you did that and just about what sort of themes you want to explore with this particular project? Was it something that you didn't see that the old stuff was particularly fulfilling, and what are you trying to achieve with the reboot?
Well, I know like a major complaint of Old Talk was that it felt like it didn't really have a central theme, or that it didn't really feel as extremely inspired. And like when I was younger, I kind of like didn't really see that. But as I kind of like stepped away from the Elder Scrolls community like a couple of times and kind of re-looked at the project, I realized it was correct. There's a lot of parts of the culture that just is kind of like basically just in like it just kind of like other parts of other Tamarelic, you know, races that are just kind of like put into Utah, at least in old Utah, that just kind of like, wasn't anything original. So as I went into rebooting the project, I wanted to really give the Ekmer their own identity, like their own strengths, their own weaknesses, their own like goals, aspirations, unique cultural themes and stuff like that. Which is where like a cause of a family and sins and guiltiness and how to be like how to have like innocence and spiritual purity and stuff like that, which is a lot of things in New Talk that they focus on, came from, because I just kind of felt like as a writer, I kind of just didn't really do a lot of goodness, creating it. And, that made me feel bad. And I kind of like, I got to fix this somehow. And I can't be an uninspired piece of crap. So, I just had to go back in and fix it, So
yep.
That's kind of like the main thing, I guess.
That's fair enough. Yeah, although it's you do realize that a project like this is never going to be finished, right?
Yeah, I do. I just
yeah.
I'm always going to have some more ideas where I'm going to be like, oh, I need to add this in here. I need to do this and this. But at least for the moment, I want to get to a point where it really kind of stands on its own.
Yeah.
Where I can kind of like look away for it for like a good like year or two, focus on my other stuff that I'm working on, and then kind of come back in like, oh, I had another idea, I'm going to write another book or add a new page or something like that. But I like just I want the project to be something that people can look at and be like, I can do better than that, and then they do something really cool and I'm gonna be like, oh, that's awesome, and then they can inspire more people to do. And if you kind of don't write something that's you write something subpar, you can't really achieve that. So
yeah, you kind of need to have those hooks in there to think, well, the basis from people to think, oh, that's an idea that I'd be interested in running with. You need to need those ideas in there to start with, rather than people thinking, oh, there's just that's what that thing is, okay, and just kind of shrug their shoulders and move on.
Like, I know like a lot of people didn't like how the Drimmer felt a lot more personalized, which is something I both agree with and disagree with, because I always thought it was kind of weird the Drimmer were like portrayed as being like these completely apathetic, unemotional like douchebags. especially since like a major part of Morrowind lore was that Dumak was basically like the bro is the bros of Nerevar, and I was kind of like, he literally had brotherly love for this dude, but apparently they're all emotional douchebags, so I don't understand if he's like the exception. But
yeah,
I was just kind of like, so I kind of toned it down a lot in New Talk, but I still kept the fact that they still kind of have feelings, which I feel like was a good direction. I wasn't gonna completely make them like the Borg, but like a lot of people want to make the Drimmer just the Borg or something we have enough of that in TES, I think. You already have the Sloat or creepy assholes or the Hiss you don't understand, We don't need everything to kind of have like minds that you can't mentally comprehend.
That's fair enough. And there's always the option of putting in a good dose of, well, that was early in their history, they're just recontextualizing stuff. So yes, I'm personally inclined to kind of take anything that the richest sources of understanding about what the Dwemer will learn is going to be a huge thing. So any kind of presentation of the Dwemer, I think, okay, this has got an Ekmuri kind of reading through some bits and thinking, well, how that's clear reference to the heart of Lorkhan, but necessarily getting that from, because that's happening in Red Mountain King with that. Sorry, I'm just kind of thinking aloud here as to how you actually reconcile it. But were you thinking of the as something that is Dane after the discovery of the heart of Lorkhan and all that sort of stuff, or was it a split that came through before that? I'm not sure that I necessarily picked that up in the things I read.
Well, I think it's kind of early in the timeline, which I still need to complete. But the major events regarding like the Nurrican and stuff like that are more or less laid out exactly in the timeline, and they branched off like way earlier, you know, before like the Red Battle of Red Mountain is that. But they're just like, hey, you guys do your stuff and stay over on your side of the grass, and stay on our side of the grass, and like their own names were Tamriel provinces that the Dwemer had extensive presence in, like Morrowind to them was called Vel'Dawn because it's a corruption of Bardenvel, and corruption more to be more Zach of Vel'Dawn and Res'Dawn. But you know, you kind of get what I'm saying. But it's basically the idea was that basically Kraganak and and Dumak were trying to get the other Dwemer clans to kind of like recouncil and kind of help out with the medium, and both the Rurikin and the Narukin were like, no, go fuck yourself. But they still knew about the medium project, so they still knew about the Heart of Lorkhan being discovered and stuff like that, and they're clearly they both were like, yeah, this is kind of a bad idea, you shouldn't mess with that, and
yeah, absolutely. So
they got like ideas from they got like the historical context of that from ancient Dwemer records, and then of course you have Ekmer like Herondale, who went to Tamriel and then came back with new information that she shared with the rest of her her people. So that's, they kind of have scraps of bits and pieces of largely inaccurate Tamrielic history before they got conquered by Uriel the Fifth and got brought into the Imperial fold.
That's kind of what I was kind of thinking to kind of lead on to next, is to why they necessarily aren't that involved with Tamriel. I mean, I know there's meta reasons for that, because if they were, then they would appear more often. But Tamriel as kind of the center of creation and something that's supposedly attractive to everything, if you believe Mysterious Akavir. I'm just curious about what the reasoning was for keeping them separate from Tamriel, apart from the obvious. I mean, because you almost have to find reasons to write that in, and kind of what those reasons are.
Right, I have to. It's always kind of a hard, always a hard time trying to figure out exactly what I wanted the Ekmer to do in regards to major historical events. Especially things that happen in Tamriel that should affect the rest of Nern. So I always have to kind of be very careful with what I can write that doesn't come across as just, oh, that's just reaching, that couldn't happen. And what are you thinking, Warden? And like, and kind of come into of a more of a, okay, this is, that makes sense. Like the Middle Dawn, for example, time went crazy for everybody. So the Ekmer kind of just, during that period of time, makes a little more sense for them to be a little bit more active and maybe possibly even going to Tamriel or doing like the plane mill when Bog Ball was trying to, absorb all of Nern. Sure, it focuses on Tamriel, but it's made a point that it's all of Nern. It's not just Tamriel he's trying to incorporate into Cold Harbor. So, and Utok, they have to deal with that shit too. So it's which is funny because every time something majorly bad happens, Ekmer kind of like, oh, it must be those Westerners again. So they kind of like That's kind of the reason why they kind of leave Tamriel alone as well, because considering that the Dremmer left and, you know, the Akaviri are always going over there, they kind of just have like a kind of like a fear of just bad things over there they don't want to deal with.
Yeah.
So they kind of just kind of keep to themselves and just, you know, mess around with like with Katnu Kay or Ezreal or Roskria, stuff like that. And every now and then you have a couple of Ekmer that go over to Tamriel, come back and are like, hey, this is some cool stuff, blah, blah, blah. And they're just like, yeah, nah. And then it's not until like Uriel Fit kind of goes out there and he's like, hey, I heard there's a group of bat people, you know, I want you guys to join the Empire. And they're like, nah. And he's like, nah, you're going to do that. And they kind of start, you know, becoming more of a presence in Tamriel history.
Yeah, cool. I was kind of curious to explore that, because that's very, very explicit kind of colonialism, if I can put it that way, in a way that, I mean, obviously Tamriel has an empire, so you've got imperialism, but that the idea of someone from somewhere else coming in and imposing whatever rule over that particular place was what sort of elements of that were you wanting to incorporate into Utak, or was that even really part of the calculus? I'm not sure I've read quite enough to pick up on any of the nuances, because an awful lot of the stuff I've been reading is Imperial scholars going over there saying, oh, this stuff is cool, look, I talked to some of the locals and here's some of their stories. So I don't know whether I've got enough of an impression to really say either way, and I'd be fascinated to know what the thought processes were behind any of that thematics if you were putting those in.
So something I realized with elves in general is that aside from the boss, where they like to be left alone, and yeah, the Ekmer still kind of had that sentiment, they're like, hey, you know, they just want to be left to their own devices. So when they kind of had got word from the other, you know, Padmeg nations that the Empire was kind of, you know, like just basically just rolling through with their ships and just taking shit, they were kind of like, okay, this is going to be interesting. And something that I actually talked to one of my other project leads, Captain Carrot, about was that, and you talk in both Utak and New Talk, but a little bit less downplayed in New Talk, is that the Ekmer are pretty good at doing what they do. They are experts at siege warfare, especially because they fight each other a lot throughout their history. They're good at, you know, espionage and stuff like that, because they're bad traits. So we kind of had to like incorporate the fact that, hey, how can we make the Empire kind of just take control of Yunnezli while kind of curse stomping them, while not making them, the Yunnezlians, kind of just fall apart immediately, because they're a little too competent to just get their asses kicked just flat out. So it's, I haven't written about it yet, and I think he wants to write about it, is that there's a lot of there's like basically a lot of spy wars going on during the colonial invasion of Yunnezlia. Basically you had like the Blades having their covert agents in Yunnezlia for a good like year or two before they even got to Yunnezlia, and then you had Ekmer like on different islands trying to like basically like eavesdropping and learning more about the Empire. So when the Empire comes, the Ekmer are kind of like, okay, we already know why you're here, we're not joining, leave us alone. And Uriel Fit, being Uriel Fit, is like, no, I am the great, how many great strengths, grand nephew of Tiber Septim, and I am going to kick your asses and you're joining my Empire. So that was pretty fun, and trying to incorporate that. And you know, it's also, I really love how the Ekmer kind of basically started venerating Uriel Fit as a god, because he literally kind of kicked their asses. But a major part of that colonialism is how the Yunnezli as a whole kind of had to get used to being part of a greater world. Because Yunnezli is actually kind of a beautiful place to be, it became a very, it became a kind of a big tourist attraction to nobles and stuff, so that will come there to go. A lot of people who didn't want to live in Tamriel anymore kind of went to Yunnezli to start a new life. And they kind of had to get used to that. And it's a lot of conflict. You can see there's you have like the Dragon Riots, you have the Stormdrake Crusades, you have a bunch of events that kind of basically start from the Ekmer kind of trying to resist this change. And by the time of the fourth era, or at least by the time of Skyrim, they're kind of like, they're basically chill. They're kind of like, they don't really, they're not a part of Empire anymore because they left as soon as the Oblivion Crisis was over. They're like, ha ha, we're out. We're not dealing with that shit. And, but they still became like, they still maintain a lot of trading, you know, partnerships, and they still help out the Empire every now and then. They're neutral and, you know, in like any conflict because they don't really want the Aldmeri Dominion and the Empire, like, you know, bearing down upon them. But, you know, they, but at the same time, their outlook about a lot of things changed, and they kind of became better people because of it. Because before, it was just them, you know, the people that, you know, the bug goblins, the other nations, and, you know, the, every once in a while, the Kamal and Tseski will try to come and, you know, invade, and they will have to drive them off. And then Tamriel, being Tamriel, is just this huge, major force of change, and they just couldn't, like, you know, bear the brunt of that, and they kind of became a part of this, you know, the Starry Heart through that, you know, through those changes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm almost thinking that it almost works like the Empire's, well, Uriel Septim had big designs on Akavir, and kind of Yunesslia is almost a footnote. So it's just kind of let's just clear the way and get everything involved. Let's install a provincial governor, just make sure they pay their taxes, and let's go on carrying on east. This kind of, and kind of carry on that way, and everything sort of flows from there. But even that's going to do things, like from an economic standpoint, I was thinking, well, what about cash crops? Because you've got to pay those taxes somehow,
right?
And that sort of thing. So it's interesting to hear that there is that Yunesslia is in that sort of that tension between being an independent place versus part of a larger empire, in a way that Tamriel in itself doesn't really seem to grapple with. It's just always, someone in Cyrodiil sits on the Ruby Throne and decides, hey, let's unify the continent. And that unification doesn't really seem to have much in the way of an impact, apart from potentially in some of the stuff that was written for the Elder Scrolls 3, I suppose. So it's nice to see that there's some of that stuff that's been explored. And just picked up on. There is another kind of element that I was picking up on some of the things I was reading through, that there are several bits that reference parts of the cosmology from Arena and Daggerfall, and also potentially for some bits, like the bits about the Dreamsleeve buying into fairly well established portions of fan lore and so on. But I'm curious about how you got all that stuff to work together. I mean, is there enough of a coherent cosmology there to try and get that to work, or is it just a case of sprinkling in some references here and there and hoping no one asks how it works?
It's more of the former, a little bit of the latter. especially like with I like to recycle gods from Daggerfall and Arena, because for one, I always dislike the fact that despite the creation myths of Tamriel and of Elder Scrolls as a whole, always referencing the fact that, you know, there's a shit ton of gods, you don't really get to see them. And although, you know, like, I know there's been some interviews where some of the devs that come out and say, oh, some of those gods are just jokes and stuff like that, or, you know, oh, they just don't really exist, they might just be fairy tales, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, in regards to Elder Scrolls, it just kind of feels almost like the world is kind of shallow if you only focus on like really eight major beings, and of those eight major beings, only one really communicates with people. And it's just which is one of the reasons why I kind of like went with, like, at least with Eros, like with Ekmer religion, and I think Hyoket religion and other parts of it have more details about that as well. Kind of how they acknowledge a greater pantheon. And that, yeah, there's some analogs to some of the Daedra princes. There's some analogs to the Aedra, but there's also gods that aren't acknowledged in any other cultures at all. And they're they're completely Ekmer gods, and they're real. You know, at least they seem to be real, but they're not part of the traditional narrative, because, you know, they're their own people. Of course, they have unique things. You don't really see that a lot in other Tamriel-like cultures. And I always feel like that's kind of like a just kind of a and bad part of the setting, that all the races don't really have really unique cultural figures and stuff like that. Or kind of how, like, at least they used to, and now it kind of just blend in together to being like, oh, that pantheon is just that pantheon with different names, you know. It's, yeah, but
yeah,
it's like the, I feel like Arena of Daggerfall just have a lot of potential, not just Arena of Daggerfall, Arena of Daggerfall, Battlespire, fucking a lot of the older games have just have a lot of interesting details that get completely glossed over by all the newer games. And kind of like, you know, using those old ideas, like Netherrealm being going from being something that was like briefly talked about in Arena to being an actual major part of Ekmer religion in New Talk, because given like kind of like revitalization of sorts is a good thing. Because sure, yeah, it might not really be something that the Tamrielics focus on, but the idea that in the center of Nirn there's this rotten, festering, basically this hellish place, created from like corrupted souls, is an Ekmer thing, because it not only does it add more flavor to their religious practices, it also gives them a more unique religious identity. A fire, and then explaining how much fire is referenced as a important element in Elder Scrolls, mm-hmm. and you get things like the Dreaming Sleeve and I guess the Lua Boris, and how you combine that with the Wheels of Lua, like you stated. And I was kind of like, well, kind of going with the idea of, you know, because like I said, they're kind of like Christians in the world where God doesn't exist, and combining that with some ancient Chinese influences along with the God and turning him into like the primordial God, you kind of create something new that still feels like it can actually be a thing in Elder Scrolls. It's another thing, kind of tying it into different, uniquer kind of part of the world building. It's a little bit confused that it's like a machine that basically both creates souls and recycles souls, and it's kind of like its own like plane of existence. Is definitely not something that's really talked about too much in the series, but it kind of like doesn't really ignore what we know about it. It just kind of goes into a different direction about it.
Yeah, because it's, as you're saying, like pulling in those different influences and just sprinkling the color in from those, at least, or some initial ideas. Because I was kind of reading through that and I was thinking this is almost Buddhist in a way that the general Elder Scrolls stuff isn't. Just to explain the idea of the idea that kind of made me think that, just for the listeners, that within the Ekmeri cosmology, they kind of blur well, they kind of have the Dream Sleeve as a soul recycling thing, as something to kind of power reincarnation. But that is combined with the Wheels of Lull, which is essentially, that's I almost took that as kind of the outer rim of the Arabis, which is kind of constantly turning and churning and pumping stuff back into the Arabis. And kind of weaving those bits together, which is apart from the kind of the more mechanical vibes you get from the Wheels of Lulland, if you're thinking about that as a potential Dwemer idea, that almost felt Buddhist as far as I read it, because there's the idea of the cycle of reincarnation is something you almost need to escape. And again, this might be me remembering some old Park stuff, but there was the idea that that ultimately the Ekma didn't really have an afterlife, that they didn't really care where they went, or didn't know where they went, or didn't think they went anywhere, something along those sorts of lines. And again, if that's combined with reincarnation, you almost have Buddhist, but I may be working with outdated information at that point.
No, you're definitely actually on the right track, because that's still a thing, and that the Ekmer don't really have an afterlife. I kind of made it a little bit more complicated in New Talk, as someone actually brought up the question. It's like, because originally in Old Talk, the Ekmer, their souls went to the void to be erased, because that's something that they always wanted. And they were like, yeah, we don't really want to be really reincarnated. We kind of want to be gone forever. And then project members, he was like, well, what about the gods? I'm pretty sure, you know, the gods kind of want at least some claim to some Ekmer souls, you know. And I was like, that's a good idea. You know, that's a, you know, that's a really good question. You know, I can't really just neglect the other gods, you know, wanting to have some Ekmer souls in their collection. So I kind of came up with the idea that, you know, when Herondale did that, the other guys almost ganged up on her and beat her ass. They were like, hey, you just can't just make an entire race exclusive from us. So her, like the god of silence had to come in and was like, hey, how about we do this? You know, every time Ekmer dies, they have to prove their worth. And, you know, if they're truly the paragon of Ekmerness, you know, they get to go to the void. If not, one of you guys can take their soul. And that's kind of like what happened. And so they're, which also kind of ties into some other, you know, vaguely Judaistic ideas with the idea of like eternal sin and stuff like that. And then like the idea, like the idea, like the mechanical aspects of reincarnation stuff and other things that you mentioned. If you, I'm not sure if it's like very obvious in some things you read, but the Ekmer kind of view mortal life as puppets. They view the, they view existence like a stage and everything's kind of like a puppet show, with the gods kind of pulling the strings and stuff like that. It's why puppets and things like that are very important in their culture, and that belief and that belief stems from the idea that they were created by the Ekmer, and they're, I mean, not by the Ekmer, by the Dwemer, and they're kind of dolls in the sense, but all mortal life are dolls, but they have more emphasis on that because they were actually created by something else. So they kind of have a sense of already kind of a disconnectedness to, I guess, like other realities, because they, to them, the Mundus is really like the only one they kind of really are a part of. So it kind of creates this kind of like dilemma where the Ekmer already kind of view themselves as kind of like less than worthy. They kind of already have like this eternal guilt and this exception with purity and being spiritually clean and not being sinful and stuff like that, that kind of arises from their idea that they are kind of like born a little bit different from everyone else. So like all these kind of concepts kind of emerge together, and then you create something that's, you know, new. That's kind of like something you don't really see like in Elder Scrolls, that but could definitely exist in Elder Scrolls.
Yeah, because there's not really, there's gods, but I struggle to think of what I would think of as religion in the Elder Scrolls, if I can put it that way. There's that sort of disconnect between the gods and what the gods do, and how that relates to what that means to believe and be part of a structure that incorporates gods into its society, if I can put it that way.
Yeah, kind of like that's actually a really good way of putting it too. It's like you have people acknowledging and worshiping the gods, but you don't really know how they do it. And whereas with like the Ekmer, you have different practices, like they have rosaries, they have, you know, they have like confessionals and stuff like that because they're fucking weird. I said, they're like, we don't really worship gods, guys. We like, they go into the house and they pray to like Jesus or something.
Yeah,
and, you know, it's just, it kind of makes them a little more believable as a people.
Yeah, no, I can absolutely see that. And thinking about souls and stuff, as an island people, did you have any specific conceptions they had about water and the like? Because obviously you've got the archipelago as an archipelago, so it's again an opportunity to fill in something that isn't really there in baseline Elder Scrolls.
Oh yeah, I definitely gave them ocean gods because they had to have them. I love their view on dragons because it's just so more unique than the Temerilic view. But they view like sea serpents and stuff like as lesser dragons and things like that, and they view like the water. They still have the memory connection with water. They view it. They also feel like purification and stuff like that. They actually have like monsters because they actually call it Skarde, and they're memory zombies, and they kind of like rise from the water and they just kind of like attack people because they're like corruptions of people's memories that kind of congeal together into like these just angry, mindless, kind of slightly undead hordes that they have to deal with from time to time. And then you also have the salt, which is another major theme in New Talk, is that salt is like kind of like the bitterness, like they're like bitter memories in like mundane form, and there it's very good to use against undead and supernatural entities, because since they don't have that kind of connection with water like mortal races do, it does is extremely effective against them as a way of purifying them or banishing them from this plane of existence. So there's like definitely a lot more emphasis on water, especially due to their nature as an archipelago, like as kind of like an island nation. And you know, like, but of course, besides from that, they also have different things like, you know, Ekmer Surf, because why not? You know, it's like, you know, they kind of have, you know, different like cool little like tidbits that, you know, they have a lot more fisherman culture. They actually have a interesting relationship with the Mariner, because or the Malamer, because you know the Malamer are largely pirates, and they actually met their Malamer more before they met mainland Tamaroleks, and they actually had a lot of cultural exchange because of that. So they have some Mariner gods in their pantheon as well. So it's
I'd have almost thought that they were too far away for that, because the because Pyandineer is almost beyond Somerset, but it depends. The sea is the sea, and you keep going until you hit land, I guess.
Pretty much. Like, I'm not going to lie and say that I understand geography in Elder Scrolls, because I don't. But, I don't think anyone does. You say you do, you're lying. But to me, I always kind of go with the idea that Nerdin is just really big. And even though it's really big, people still explore it. And the Malamer being a race of people, just they're literally called the sea elves. To me, it makes sense that everyone else in the canon, they're the ones that kind of explored the oceans the longest. They have like different like little like sea territories and stuff like that that they use as bases to launch attacks and stuff like that. Otherwise, I don't really know why they're sea elves. They just sit with Orgnil and be depressed because they didn't get to live in Somerset.
Yeah, that makes sense. You've got to have something for them to do to keep them. Well, I was about to say to keep them out of mischief, but keep them into mischief is probably more appropriate. Ed. You're talking about kind of developing the Ekmara's kind of unique takes on things. One of the things that that's kind of stood out to me is, again, one of the more unique bits is kind of an unusual attitude to magic. The idea of having magic user licenses, and that it's kind of frowned on and just minimalized in a way that it's not, that you don't really see anywhere else on Tamriel. It's not like they simply hate all spellcasters and kind of almost kill them on sight like the Red Guards seem to do, or kind of think that that anyone who's involved with magic is stupid and should be avoided like the Nords. But can you kind of explore a bit more about what that perception was? It from what you've been saying earlier, it feels a bit more like that. It's an extension of that kind of risk-averse nature. If they're not wanting anything to do with Tamriel because it could land them in huge amounts of trouble, then they don't want to be involved with the magic that causes most of these disasters as well. I don't know if that's the reason for it or whether it's something else.
Like a part of it. But you also have to remember that when the Dremor disappeared, at least in the New Talk timeline, the Ekmer and the Dremor were having a war with the Netherrealm. So you have to realize that for them, like for the Dremor disappeared, it was like a traumatizing event for their early ancestors, and they kind of attributed it to magic. They were like, "Oh shit, magic can do this. It can just wipe out people. Fuck that, dude. Let's not use it that much." And you know, it kind of like trickled down from there. So still, it kind of became like this. It wasn't like an evil thing. They acknowledge that magic has to be around so people can actually, you know, build and, you know, innovate and stuff like that. But for them, they're kind of like, it's dangerous if it's not controlled. So Ekmer society kind of revolved around that idea until the modern day, where you have to have a license to practice magic in Yennezlid. You had to
actually get official training, you need to go through a screening process a little bit. You know, it's kind of almost similar to like a, I'm not for sure you play Dragon Age or not, but you know, the Venter Imperium from Dragon Age, where they have a very strict use of magic and stuff like that. And not to mention, I also always kind of looked at it as kind of like, it's kind of like a dig at Tamriel itself, because 95% of Tamriel shenanigans happen because someone was using magic inappropriately and no one actually tried to say anything about it.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of Tamriel's problems would never happen if someone was just like, hey, dude, are you authorized to use that spell? No, okay, you gotta stop. Come with me. You gotta go down to the sheriff's office. You know, we need all you in the books. You know, like even the Ekmer kind of make fun of the Tamriels because of that. Are like, ha, you guys have all this stuff happening because you don't actually try to prevent it from happening. You know, they just teach magic to everyone.
Yeah, although that's kind of feels a bit sort of centralized for Yennefer so far. That can you kind of talk a bit more about how the government works for that? Because I've not really got into this bit of it too much, but the idea of the directorate rather than being something that's monarchical as such, or even whether it's something close to the Morrowind's Grand Council, the wording feels again closer to modern day republicanism or democracy than anything that's on Tamriel.
I can definitely see how it comes across as that, but it's actually in like the old talk, it definitely was that because I was stupid back then. And the talk, it actually has a lot more context for that. Mm-hmm. Is that Beckmer actually used to be very monarchical. They had kings who had their birthright, because there's a relic in Yennefer called the Rhetoric Throne that originally was a Dremer relic that was created to oversee all the facilities and stuff in the Dretch, and it had like things to utilize the calling and stuff like that. When the Dremer disappeared, the Ekmer kind of inherited it. It kind of became a symbol of authority. Every king and queen that ever sit on that would rule Yennefer would sit on the Rhetoric Throne, and then. But after Herondale kind of gave the Rhetoric Throne a little bit more magical power, where you could converse with like all the dead kings and queens of Ekmeri lineage, you know, it started becoming corrupted. It started getting more disdainful, a little bit more chaotic, and it started killing, you know, people who sat on it. Until eventually there's a civil war where Hanar almost king, almost conquered Yennezlia, and then he got killed, and the Rhetoric Throne stopped accepting anyone to sit on it. So that's how their monarchy kind of ended. They kind of felt like there was no Ekmer alive anymore that deserved to be king of their place, of their government. So the Council of Dual Chimes, who were the advisors of the kings and queens of old, kind of became the ruling body of the Yennefer government. And that's also a reason why they kind of have a major contention with the Empire, because that for the longest time, Yennefer didn't have a king. They felt like kings were a very spiritual and very cultural important part of their society, and they lost the right to have a king. So when you have a dude that, you know, have an emperor that's kind of imposing that he's your new king, kind of doesn't really sit right with you.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like, right, you say you're our king, okay, the throne's over there, sit.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. And see what happens. Yeah, that absolutely makes sense. It's also it kind of has those Arthurian vibes. I mean, I can quite happily imagine a cult of Ekmer somewhere that are saying, well, these are all the bloodlines of the previous kings, and that's where they're all interacting now. So if these two can converge, then we can probably get someone who's got all of the necessary components to be able to sit on the throne again in maybe 10 generations time, sort of thing. That kind of mapping, and just trying to have the hope for someone to overthrow it and to overthrow the directorate and then kind of go forward to present someone into the throne again. But yeah,
like the complete opposite. So that's the complete opposite of Anarchus, like Monarchus.
Yeah, that's kind of what that's. I'm just kind of thinking. Yeah, that just kind of sling some Bene Gesserit ideas into the ECMA and see where it takes you. But I think that's about most of the stuff that I had down to chat through. But although just hearing you, a throwaway word there that we've barely touched on at all, you mentioned the Dweech in passing, which is this the underscore. As I can understand it, the underground portions of Yunusleah, that's basically it's not exactly the Underdark, but it's a place where some of the clans live, and it's a bit more of a hazardous place. And it's also from the sound of the history where a lot of the bad stuff bubbles up from, given their take on all of the bad stuff coalescing in the center of. In the center of Nern, it was kind of being closer to that bad stuff must have some sort of an impact on the ECMA who live there.
Oh yeah, definitely. Especially in regards to how, because I'm working on like a gigantic update for the project at the moment. As you know, it's going to go into like Yunusleah as a place to live, and all of its geography and cities and stuff like that. And the Dweech is going to get its own portion, but basically, it's explained that Yunusleah probably was actually really, really big, you know, at the probably the beginning of time. And then as the water receded and stuff like that, it became a little bit smaller. So it went from being like almost like the size of a province and a half to basically being like maybe almost on par with Somerset. Maybe. Like if you combine all the islands together, you know, like it's still pretty big, but it's not like it's nowhere near like a probably like L-square or something like that. But the Dweech is like the underground portions of all these islands, and they all kind of connects them all together, and that's like their ancestral home. So they predominantly live underground, but they still have a lot of people who live above ground as well. And because the Dweech is like its own kind of like environment, like there's actually like weather patterns in the Dweech. Like there's different like biomes that you wouldn't see. Another project member, his name Will, he came up with like the fantastic idea that the Dweech is inspired by microorganisms. So it's going to be very creepy if you're not into gigantic microorganisms, then it's probably not going to be your thing. But you know, so you know, the ECMA on the boards, they eat anything, so they don't care. But
fair enough. That feels a little close to some of the original Morrowind inspirations of let's just have bugs and make them really big.
Yeah, a little bit. It's like not insects this time. Giant like cephalopods and creepy things like that. Ooh. And you know, it's ooh, like so you got like different like biomes that are like you think that's a tree? No, that's actually a animal that looks like a tree, and it's. And it's breathing when you touch it and stuff like that. So it's, I gotta get more artwork for it. There's a couple of pieces every day you can see. There's like one where you can actually look at how like it's like its own ecosystem of plant lives and animal lives that are like merged together. And then you have these areas with their different like cities and villages, and the Dweech itself is actually kind of like only one real city there, and it's like a gigantic, like ancient dwarf facility that's been like augmented over the centuries, and has like these kind of like highways that the dwarves built, not like a road, but like these like kind of like very smooth tunnels that lead to each part of the city, and it's just like this. It's almost it's kind of similar to the Underdark, but it's. It's just different enough where you're kind of like, okay, this is actually kind of cool.
Yeah, I was trying to think, okay, so what comparisons can we make to the Underdark? Should we make comparisons?
I mean, I would say no, but you already have Blackreach, and ESL kind of already went in that direction with Blackreach. So, and then I remember I saw like a Reddit post or somebody. I was like, what if all of Nern is just like has these underground caverns that are all connected, and you have like these underground Nern battles? And I was just kind of like. I mean, why not?
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, I think that's about probably all that we can cover without going into huge amounts more rabbit holes, but I think I'm probably going to open the largest one of the lot and say, what areas do you want to explore with the UTAC project that you haven't really got to yet? I mean, it sounds like you've got, there's however many different plates spinning because of all the contributors, but are there any areas that you haven't, that you want to see developed further than you've got at the moment?
I'm almost done with the geography page. I really want to dive deep into how they understand and use magic. Like, that's going to be another future page in the future. You're going to have a page with all their wars and all their major battles, how their transportation is and stuff work. Like, there's a lot of different things. I kind of want to, I think a major thing I really do need to finish is the balancing towards a Starry Sea, which is their pocket guide to Inezlia, because once I finish it, and I think I have permission to do this, I got to double check, but the last time I asked, they basically gave me a, yeah, sure, why not answer, but I might be able to print that out and give those to people. So, it depends. Utah is in a very special place with Bessida, so... I can't really do too much, but I actually have more leeway than people might think, so who knows?
Cool. Fair enough. Oh, that is awesome. That sounds absolutely fantastic. But thank you ever so much for taking the time to chat LJ. It's been an absolute pleasure talking through all this stuff with you. But if people want to contribute to UTAC, where do they go? What can they do to get on board? Because I'm sure that there are some people listening to this who will want to play with some of the ideas that we've talked about.
Yeah, there's the Discord server that has a link to it on the main UTAC page on USB. I'm always available. You can reach out to me on Reddit or through different Discord servers. And once there, you can just ask me about the project. I can help you with the different questions and stuff you have, show you where the FAQ is and stuff like that. If you have any like questions that are on it, and pretty much just let me hear your ideas, and you know, I'm always open to listening to what people have to say. So
cool. And I will drop as many of those links as possible in the show notes for this episode, so you don't need to go hunting down anywhere. Go to wherever you're listening to this, click on the links that are in the episode notes, and take it from there. Is there anything else that you want to talk over that we haven't already discussed at this point, either about UTAC or anything else? Because I know I seem to remember you have at least one other project going on.
Not particularly. I have my personal book that I'm working on that hopefully I can get published sometime in maybe like next year. I have a Dark Souls essay that the first part's already been released. I'm considering doing another part to my Prisoner essay that got re-released like a year ago. Yeah. And then I also have like some, hopefully some lore related things I can get done with an official capacity, maybe soonish if I can pull that off. But mainly like outside like my writing and stuff, I just try to see what I can do to help get more lore related content with the community. And so I'm always trying to see what I can, you know, get done that we can like, you know, release and be like, hey, look at this stuff, new lore, and you know, people can eat that up.
Nice. Okay, brilliant. Okay, in which case, thank you, and thank you so much, LJ. As ever, if anyone has any questions or anything they want to grab me about, tweet me at Aramithius and get hold of me or at writtenuncertaintypodcast@gmail.com. And next time, we will be taking a dive into some of the more space fantasy bits of The Elder Scrolls and asking the questions about the big stompy robot. Next time, we are going to be asking, what is the Numidium? Until then, this podcast remains a letter written in uncertainty. You've been listening to Written in Uncertainty, a podcast written and hosted by Aramithius, with a kind guest appearance from Icefire Warden or Adhatur, and edited and mixed by Dopportunity. The music for this podcast has been kindly provided by Jan Glembotsky. Check them out on SoundCloud under Songs from the Lost Land, and I'll see you next time.
Looking for an RPG podcast that isn't just D&D?
Roll to Cast is the answer.
No, wait, sorry. What games have we played so far?
Well, we've done Cyberpunk 2020.
What does it mean to have a voice?
And there's going
to
be something big coming, Chumba.
Hey, if you're listening, I won. I beat you. You suck.
There was a time when we were slamming things against our phones and...
Vampire the Masquerade.
Chloe, Sam.
You can't use those words!
He's going to grab Vincent, press him against the wall.
I mesmerize him.
This is Adelaide's Anarch move. First out of your chair, your hand goes to your gun and you draw.
Pulp Cthulhu.
Told you I had it.
Oh, we've all got the creeps going. I love it so much.
All right there. Screechy child.
My favorite daughter.
Maybe after what we just seen, we're feeling a bit trigger happy.
And the new Cyberpunk Red.
Babe, you're good, but better.
Thought maybe you might be able to give me a counter off.
Dos for Danya.
Straight through his neck.
I don't see bone either, but I'm not gonna look.
My leg's fine.
I always knew you wanted to fly, kid. Come find me.
Roll to Cast.
R-O-L-E.
A new game every season.
Original music.
Original stories.
Interviews with the creators.
And delightful Aussie accents.
Listen to us on all good podcatchers.
You can support us on Patreon for bonus content.
That's Roll to Cast.
R-O-L-E.
Come discover a new world.
Hello.
Hi.
Do you like bad movies?
Do you find yourself defending bad movies, saying things like, well, the soundtrack was okay, or the costumes were pretty fun?
From the previous hosts of It's Not That Bad podcast, we bring you Fresh Tomatoes, the movie podcast, from Simone LaRue and Chad Ekovitz.
Every week, we review two movies that did not do well critically, but we say, hey, there are some nice things about them. Maybe Rotten Tomatoes was wrong.
Maybe they're all fools, and you should watch these movies regardless. We'll also talk about scenes that could have saved it, and we'll often refer to Simone's cats because they're amazing and adorable, and we love them.
And at the end of each review, we will tell you whether we would watch this movie again, or in what circumstances we would recommend you watch this movie.
So, join us on July 9th for the first drop of our main episode, and then 2 days later for our drop of our minisodes.
And on Robots Radio Podcast Network. Come see us on July 9th. We love you so much already. Bye!
Ahoy there, ye landlubbers! Avast! My name is Captain Logan, and I'll be your guide out on the Sea of Thieves. If you love the idea of stealing treasure, cutting down cursed skeletons, fighting off krakens, and raiding forts filled to the brim with shinies, then Sea of Thieves is the game for you. Join me each week as I dive into the news and bring back the nuggets of information that any sailor worth their weight in salt would desire. You don't have to be a pirate legend to gain access to my podcast. Just search for Keelhauled, a Sea of Thieves podcast in your podcast app of choice, or head over to robotsradio.net or captainlogan.podbeam.com and get ready to set sail for adventure. Arrgh.